You there? Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Guaranteed annual income. The Inuit, however, rejected this. We thought that what it would do would be give a great incentive for not working. What we opted for was a hunter support program. And in this program, instead of going out and giving everybody a guaranteed income, we thought that already in place were unemployment insurance and the welfare systems that were already in place were adequate. What we did with the funds was we set it up in a program that is administered by the villages, and we can make our own rules for it. But the general objective of the program is to be able to give assistance to people who are unable to hunt, so that they can be able to receive country foods, as we would call it. And also, the funds have been used for different things throughout the villages. In some instances, they've used it to be able to purchase, safety equipment like life jackets or safety flares or things like that, or trail radios, long-range HF radios. And purchase these goods and sell them back to the villagers at a reduced rate. To give you an example of how this has worked, in one village they bought life jackets for everybody, enough for everybody in the village, and then people could go to the local council and buy a life jacket. The person who was administering the program knows everybody in the village, so he'd say, well, you're making a good income, you pay the full price. Another person would come in, he doesn't have a job, he'd say, okay, you get it free. They've also been used in many villages to buy wildlife resources like fish, caribou meat, pay people to go out, pay for their gas, and pay them a small wage to go out and gather food, and then make the food available for free to the village. So whoever needs that food can go and get it. It's also been used in some villages to purchase communal property, which would be like large fishing boats. Quite a few of our villages have gone and purchased 40-foot boats that they could use for communal harvesting activities. If a particular resource is lacking in one area, they can also use these funds to pay for the transport costs and do a food exchange with another village. But these funds are all internally regulated. One thing we found was that MUTTAC is something that we like so much. We found that the villages, by using these funds, were putting a great deal of pressure on the whales. So we made a rule that none of the villages can buy or could use these funds to purchase subsidize anything to do with whaling, because it was putting too much pressure on the whale resources we had. Land is owned by the community, and the community decides that it's in the community benefit to take over somebody's trapping lodge and because it's their land, and develop a tourist industry or something around that area. What rights does that individual have for compensation from his own village? These types of questions are slowly starting to come up, and there is nothing to deal with them. It would make a very interesting court case, but I would hope that we didn't have to go that far. We're starting to find out that there's going to be areas of dispute in the notion of collective rights of the native people and the individual rights. I'll go into this further when we talk a bit more about the constitutional issue. We went quite far in trying to preserve certain notions of collective rights. And in doing so, we forgot the individual protections required by the individuals within our collectivities. And just one observation about the whole constitutional discussions. Everybody's screaming about collective rights, but our societies have the same capacity of doing injustice to individuals. So we need some kind of general protections for the individuals within our notions of collective rights. It's all good and well to fight really hard for collective rights and collective ownership and all this, but don't do it at the price of individuals, because the native I know that we're good principles as consensus and all of this, but there is the real possibility of individuals being unjustly served by the community, and these mechanisms are lacking in our agreement, and I have not yet seen any agreement that proposes any kind of individual protections in terms of what rights and what properties are held communally. The individual area is lacking in all claims, and so far, luckily, this has been more of a theoretical question, but the possibility of it coming to a loggerhead is any minute this may happen, that we're going to run into this conflict, and then this will have to be resolved one way or the other. We're starting to think about how we might be able to do it. One of the ways is to have general constitutionalized provisions that would ensure protection of the individuals within those collectivities. But that's not yet evolved. The discussions has not yet evolved. It's we've had to start seeing the potential for that problem after the experience of having a claim settlement. The groups that have not had a claim settlement have not yet to had to even think about this.
Well, I think we have time for Peter Atinwar and Chuck Smythe to ask questions, and then we'll adjourn for lunch. And after lunch...
agreement or compensation to the local Sami population. And in connection with the development of the petroleum issue, the Sami Institute has been working on a pilot project on several aspects, including an inventory of models, especially those we are talking about today, and also the COPE agreement. And one of our researchers has done a summary of this in a paper for our institute. I would just like to pose a question in connection to this summary to see whether he has got it right or I have understood it correctly. He said that there is made a distinction between areas in the COPE agreement relating to subsurface rights. There are areas around six local villages of 1,813 square kilometers, plus an area of 2,072 square kilometers on Cape Bathurst that include subsurface rights. And then there have been selected more than 26,000 square kilometers and an additional area of 56,000 square kilometers, which will include surface land rights. My interest in this is what is the background for the distinction that there has been obtained a subsurface right in a localized area around the villages and not in a more extensive area? Or has there been done any subsurface inventory or research as a base for this? Yes, thank you.
One of the main justifications given for selecting or including subsurface in the community selections was that the communities would have a great say in potential development that would occur in and around them, and you know that would have a significant impact. But they were not specifically chosen, officially anyway, because of the potential non-renewable resource that they might contain.
Do you want to follow that up, Al Fayzi?
Well, is there any indication that the issue of subsurface rights might be extended into more extensive areas within the agreement? Or is there any clause that extinguishes the discussion on subsurface rights in total?
No, the balance between surface and subsurface is essentially maintained in the final agreement, and no provision is included for changing that in the future.
Sand and gravel are, you say, classified as surface rights.
That's correct.
Chuck Smythe?
I had a couple of questions for clarification. You mentioned that descendants will receive shares automatically. What happens upon the death of a shareholder to his shares?
He ceases to become a shareholder, and no, there are no benefits to his heirs.
So they go back to the corporation?
That's correct.
A two-part question relating to land. Is land from the settlement going to be transferred to individuals at all? And in what form are they transferred to the community?
It is proposed that the land would be transferred in fee simple to one holding corporation, and the corporation can then manage that land in accordance with the conditions that it cannot be sold to a non-Inuvialuit corporation or individual. Inuvialuit individuals or private companies would be able to purchase land if the Inuvialuit decided that they wanted to sell land, but that individual or corporation within not
the common government, common services, and dealing with a community, a village, where you have both Indian and white people living in the villages. We have agreed to set up one common system of government to deal with the government services of providing roads, providing the water system, fire protection. All those type of common services will be set up under a local village or town government, which would be incorporated under the territorial, the existing territorial laws. In addition, we've agreed to set up band governments. Band governments would have the responsibility to exclusive responsibilities, for example, in management of trapping areas, management of the hunting and game regulations on Indian land. They'll be responsible for the all the things that we term traditional, in terms of culture, all the things that we consider unique as Indian people. The band governments will have exclusive authority. And lastly, we agreed to set up a central Indian authority. This would be incorporated under the settlement legislation. It would be responsible for things of general nature. In other words, for example, appointment to territorial game board. This central Indian authority would make all the appointments for the native nominees for that board. It would have that type of responsibility.
How would the central Indian authority be chosen?
We agreed to the concept of a central Indian authority, but we haven't yet done the studies to in consulting the native people in the communities or the bands and how this is to be set up. But while it would be a central Indian authority, a lot of its authority would more or less be that which is given to it by the villages. In other words, the bands would be the main landowners, In other words, all the land that's been selected would be held by the Indian bands, and this authority, while it will be worked on, we've got a study underway now to suggest to us how this should be set up. We haven't agreed to the details of how it would be set up in terms of, and how it would choose its members and how it would be governed. The next element of our claim is dealing with land. Under lands, we have three different categories of land. We have lands for community purposes, we have rural lands, and we have site specifics. Community lands are those lands within existing communities. In other words, we have the 15 communities in Yukon Territory, and a lot of the lands right now are held by the commissioner under the territorial government, but we've been permitted, and they've agreed to transfer some of their lands to the bands. And the second category is the rural lands. These are large blocks of land surrounding the communities. For example, the lands in the south, the communities in the south, there are five communities in the south, and they've agreed to a land quantum of 0.86 square miles per person, and roughly works out to about approximately 500 square miles for the southern bands. And each band would hold approximately 500 square miles of land. In the north, they're a little more generous. They've agreed to 1.1, and this works out roughly between 600 and 700 square miles of land. And the far north, dealing with the lands in the Old Crow area, they've agreed to 8 square miles per person. In other words, in Old Crow, the community would own some 3,000 square miles of land, whereas in the south, you'd own approximately 300 to 500 square miles of land. These lands would be held in fee simple. They would be held by the band corporations, and only the improvements on the land would be taxed. In other words, if you build a house, only the value of the house would be subject to taxation, whereas raw land would not be subject to taxation. And the other element of these lands is that while the lands would be available for sale to anybody, the lands cannot be subject to seizure for non-payment of taxes. The site specifics. We have a lot of cabins, we have a lot of fishing sites, we have Indian graves, and a lot of historical areas which have been very important to the Indian people. And the government and the parties have agreed to set aside 2 to 6 hectares of land, in other words, to protect those areas, those fishing sites, the grave sites, the trapping cabins, and all those historical areas we have identified. And we have a lot of those. We have something like 70 sites per community. For example, Whitehorse would have their community lands, approximately 400 square miles of rural lands, and in addition to that, 70 or so site-specific areas to which would be held and owned by the band outright.
You mentioned the measurement by hectares. Can you convert that for us? We're in the United States. You don't use that, do you?
Yeah, the hectare is about 2.47 acres.
Thank you.
The last element of our claim deals with money compensation. The government has agreed to pay $183 million in 1980 dollars over a period of 20 years, and it works out to $620 million beginning in the year 1986. This money would be held in the trust corporation, and the trust corporation would have a total control over the monies. We have this would be set up under the existing laws. However, we've written in a number of things. For example, it would be tax-free for 10 years, and it would won't it, it the investment, in other words, the investment won't be tied to what is now existing. We'd have a broader say in terms of how we can invest the money, as long as the money is used for Indian purposes. And this is quite broad. It's not limited to charitable or education. And we do have a lot of leeway in how the money can be spent, and it won't be captured by the tax laws. We would have the break for 10 years, and after 10 years would be subject to the normal taxation. However, the government says that in 10 years they believe this fund would be, in terms, $1.2 billion. And they said if we were to get it for 20 years, the trust corporation would become too powerful and would have a great monopoly in the Yukon territory in terms of the economic life of the Yukon. So while they sympathize with us, they can see the advantages in 20 years is that the Indian people will be one of the greatest landholders, and also one of through the Trust Corporation become very powerful in terms of the economic life of the Yukon territory.
I have the feeling I've heard this before. Could you tell us how the Trust Corporation would be held? Who owns the Trust Corporation? How do they own it?
The Trust Corporation would be established under the existing laws. And right now we believe the 12 bands would each have a share in the Trust Corporation, and it would be managed centrally with subsidiaries. In other words, each band would have the right to set up a Trust Corporation to transfer funds from the central trust to their own trust, the band Trust Corporation. In other words, we have right now a study underway to determine how the details can be worked out to provide for more community control. Blessing, and in our view, the test of this claims package is very high. You know, need 10 of the 12 communities, and right now our guess is that we don't have it. With respect to where the CYI leadership stands in this the settlement offer, we'll know very shortly where they stand, because we have election coming up in approximately 2 months, and there's no doubt that this claims offer would be a central issue, and the whole question of extinguishment and where people stand will come out. In other words, all the people who are running for the leadership will have to make a stand, because the community people will demand it. And on the basis of that, I think it's going to be a very clear question to the people of Yukon Territory where they stand, and it's a very good process.
It would be hard to say what is the most important feature of the Yukon Agreement in principle, although it may not be the most important feature from the Canadian point of view. The most innovative may well be the opening up of enrollment eligibility to non-status as well as status people. For Alaska, the most innovative feature of your agreement in principle might well be the provisions relating to the use of fish and wildlife. The joint management establishment of quotas and allocation of a percentage of the quota in perpetuity to the Indian people. That is a very interesting development. Bill Rasmus and Rick Hardy, you had questions, I think.